Given our recently won ability to re-engineer life, they say our future now looks like an apple that will not spoil. Some, however, see hope in the past, and so are planting a mother orchard of heritage trees. This hope in heritage leads us to ask, should we hold on to the seeds of our past?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 973rd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Drummondville who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Hey, Aaron, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Now, which do you trust most as the source of your food? An apple that has been re-engineered not to spoil? Or an apple from a tree that has survived for hundreds of years on its own?
I'm going to go with the latter. Tree that survived hundreds of years.
Okay, there it is. Folks, given our recently won ability to re-engineer life, we can now grow an apple that will not spoil, or at least not spoil for an exceptionally long period of time. In fact, the Okanagan Specialty Fruit Company has submitted a Granny Smith apple genetically re-engineered to resist browning to the Canadian Food Inspection Service for approval. The hope, one suspects, is that the re-engineered apple will sit on a grocer's shelf for however long it takes for you and I to come by and buy the thing. Given this recently won ability to re-engineer life, the future would seem to hold much promise. We note with interest, however, that some are looking to the past instead of the future for hope. Among them are members of the Felix Gillette Society, or Institute, I guess. Well over 100 years ago, a horticulturalist named Felix Gillette imported, bred, and introduced many of the important commercial fruit, grape, and nut varietals to America's West Coast. Many of Gillette's introductions are still popular sellers today, while others provided the breeding stock for even more of today's top sellers. Members of the Felix Gillette Institute wish to preserve the genetic heritage introductions by establishing a mother orchard in which all would be allowed to grow in commercial-free peace. This effort leads us to ask, should we invest in holding on to the past when the future is said to look so promising? To help us find an answer today, we are traveling up to California's gold country to meet one of organic agriculture's true pioneers, Amigo Bob Cantisano. I first met Amigo Bob way back when at an EcoFarm conference up in La Honda, California. It was at the dawn of organic agriculture, and the organic lentils being served up for chow that day raised a great ruckus, kind of like the scene in Blazing Saddles around the campfire. Get my drift? Well, so much has transpired since then, so I just have to ask Amigo Bob. Holy smokes, Amigo, are you just amazed by the growth of organic agriculture? Are you there?
Golly, organic agriculture has changed dramatically since I got involved with it and has gone from a fringe part of society into almost mainstream. And at least almost everywhere you travel in the country these days, you can find something that was grown organically, even in the most backwater spots, which certainly wasn't the case back in the day. When you and I first met, you could find lots of good organic food around Santa Cruz or San Francisco or the Bay Area, but you didn't have to travel too far, and you soon dropped off a cliff. That's changed a lot, and that's partly because organic farmers have gotten substantially better at farming. There's a lot more of us today than there was back in the 70s or 80s. And there's a lot more consumers that are interested in this.
Well, I have to ask you, as like the Johnny Appleseed of organic agriculture, I hope you don't mind if I use that term, but that's kind of how I see you. What do you enjoy most? Do you enjoy helping organic agriculture become more conventional? Or do you enjoy helping conventional agriculture become more organic?
Well, I'd have to say I enjoy both, but actually in my day-to-day work as a farming advisor, the majority of my clients for 30 years or more have been conventional farmers who saw the light and wanted to convert and transition to organic farming. So I get great pleasure in working in that because these are wonderful human beings who have typically just been misled about the style of agriculture they were taught, and they learned that there might have been another way to go, and I happen to be in the right place at the right time to help them do that, and that's really fulfilling. I get to see them reach a level of success. I also note, and flies in contrast to a lot of what's considered rhetorically these days, I work with a lot of people who have been cast as industrial organic farmers. These are large-scale farmers who went organic.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've learned about working with those people is that they may not have started into this business with the same set of ethics that I did or ideals. I got into it because of environmental and human aspects. They got into it most of the time because of the business aspects. But what is really exciting is that virtually every one of them, after they're in there a while, they realize that there's a much bigger picture that they've now immersed themselves in. And to have a farmer stand in a field with me and point out the hawk that's flying over his field that's eating his gophers, which he'd never noticed before, is, to me, that's phenomenal. They get it. They start to understand it. And no matter what scale, I have clients that farm thousands of acres, and they recognize their relationship with nature is now closer than it was when they were farming with chemicals.
What is it that first attracts them, amigo, to organic agriculture? Is the fact that consumers out here are saying, hey, I want the organic stuff and not the conventional stuff. Is that what first grabs their attention, the fact that there is a consumer demand for organic produce?
Yeah, I'd say vast majority of them, with a few exceptions, but I probably would guess in excess of 90% of the people I've worked with actually saw a market developing. They either directly saw it from a consumer, or they went to a farmer's market, or they had a buyer that was looking for organic product, or they sold to a processor who was developing an organic line. So initially, they are lured into this by the perception that there is a market that they can fill.
So this really is a world then driven by the consumer, by city people who are looking for the right kind of food in their mind, and they reach out and say, this is what we want, and agriculture sees that demand and says, well, okay, I guess I better figure this out. Amigo, help me!
I think it happens some that way, and then there's certainly a group of people who come to it from the ethics that's from their own soul and heart. Mm-hmm. You get a good mix, but if you're talking about the majority of the conventional farmers that got into organics, you'd have to say that they typically were led by the consumer. So the consumer does call the tune. If they spend the money on the things that they admire and are in touch with, the marketplace will follow.
And what do the conventional agricultures first see when they're making the transition to organic, you know, when they start to recognize that, oh my goodness, there's life in the soil now?
Well, I think they first find out it's a lot more complicated than they thought. In fact, a really common conversation the first couple times I'm with somebody is they're kind of just looking for a substitute for their process that they were using with chemicals. They want to know what an organic spray might be for a problem they had, or what kind of fertilizer can they use that'll be legal for organic. But as they get into a ways, they realize that it's a much more detailed, complicated system, which requires more planning on their part. And I hear this a lot, that they like the challenge of it. I think everyone, to some degree, likes to succeed at something that they find difficult. And organic farming is difficult, make no question about it. It's harder to do this than it is with chemicals. Chemicals have quite a high level of success. There's a lot of known. There's a big support system from both the researchers and the universities and the manufacturers. The buyers are all there. When you get into organics, there's a lot of unknowns, and you have to figure it out yourself a lot. And I think that, in fact, I know it does. It stimulates people. They get excited about this, and they find out that, oh, I need to have a crop rotation, and I need to manage my organic matter to get a more lively soil. And when I have a healthier soil, oh, look, I have less insects or I have less diseases. In fact, that's a really interesting phenomenon that I see it so many times now. People who got into organics were assuming that they would actually have more problems with insects and disease because they didn't have the heavy-duty tools they previously had. And sometimes in transition, that's true because the soil's out of whack and the farmer's still kind of learning the systems. But almost universally, that farmer sees that system stabilize and their problems reduce.
Wow. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with amigo Bob Cantisano. Oh, boy, we're going to have fun today. We're going to focus in on the question of should we invest in our heritage and saving our heritage, or should we just go with the promise of science and re-engineer everything so we have a bright future? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city greenbelts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, folks, if you want to get right down to the ground floor of agriculture, way down there on the first floor where there is still life in the soil, I encourage you to pick up a copy of Acres USA magazine, because if anything will get you down to the ground floor of agriculture where there's still life left in the soil, it's Acres USA. I picked up my copy out of the mailbox this week, and lo and behold, guess what I found in it? I found amigo Bob Cantisano, and I have him on the radio. We're talking about some wonderful things that he discovered along the way to becoming the Johnny Appleseed of organic agriculture. And so that's one of the things we're going to be picking up today. But before we do, I have a question for amigo that I've been asking around. And I recently was putting together a speech for the American Apple Processor Association. And I ran across an interesting graphic published by Dr. Augustus Dunning. And it was a graphic detailing the nutrient loss in apples. And he made the assertion, whether it's true or not, I don't know, that in 1950, the average apple contained 4.3 milligrams of iron. But by the year 2000, the average apple contained only 0.18 milligrams of iron. So to get the equivalent amount of iron from today's apple that we got in 1950, when one would have to eat 26 apples. So this notion is stuck in my head, and here I have amigo Bob. So, amigo, what the heck happened to the nutrients in our apple?
Well, Michael, that's a really good question, and one that unfortunately hasn't been really answered scientifically, but I can give you my impression. A couple things happened. One is that varieties have changed radically in the last 50 years. And in the process of variety change, which means that people have brought out newer varieties, breeders, there hasn't been an emphasis on nutrition. And so what's been the emphasis on apple breeding is size and color and, to a lesser extent, flavor. And so focusing on those, that's one part of the problem, is that there may or may not have been focusing on nutrition. That's one piece. The second one is that growing apples today is a much more intensively farmed system than it was in 1950. The orchards are planted on much denser plantings, and they require, because of that, a lot more fertilization and water. Whenever you add nitrogen and water to plants, you dilute the rest of the nutrients out. And in order to get the high yields that they now get with these modern varieties, they put a lot of fertilizer on, way more than they did 75 years ago. And in fact, in many cases, people, other than maybe some manure and a cover crop, didn't fertilize apples back in the day. All those old dry farm orchards around Corralitos, for example, those trees, you know, effectively have been growing on their own. And they're mining the soil, finding nutrients. And trace minerals like iron, those come into the plant when the plant develops a root system, a fibrous root system that can mine into all different areas. Well, when a plant has to do that, it does. But if it's force-fed water and fertilizer, it has a much smaller root system because the plant is essentially on an IV system. It doesn't need to work. And so what's happened, and this is not just in apples, it's happened in lots of crops, is because we're on so much heavier fertilization and irrigation practices than we were 50 or 100 years ago, we've effectively diluted the nutrient level because the root system of the plant is not out working, finding all those trace minerals.
So there we go. You know, I also think that because we've become so smart at how to do things scientifically, we've also figured out how to invest the minimum to get the maximum.
Yes.
And in old-time farming, you know, farmers really didn't have that knowledge. And so probably, you know, they were probably putting a lot of things in the soil that we just don't put in anymore because we don't think we need it.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, actually, I mean, just as simple as, you know, the people that mentored me who farmed in the 1800s, early 1900s, they all spread manure. And, you know, that contains all kinds of nutrients.
There you go, yeah.
Nitrogen. Whereas if you just buy a bag of commercial fertilizer, all you get is elemental nitrogen or phosphorus or potassium. You don't get all those trace minerals. So even if they didn't have the inherent scientific knowledge, they had the wisdom to apply something that was good for all life and contained the whole spectrum of minerals.
Well, when I opened up my Acres USA, there you were, and you were talking about the Felix Gillette Institute, and I thought, holy smokes, I've never heard of Felix Gillette. And I loved your discovery tale. So tell us how you discovered Felix Gillette.
Yeah, it was a kind of a long, involved process, but I'll make it short. I live up in the Sierra foothills in the Gold Country outside of Nevada City, California. And I was living on a piece of land in 1970 with a group of friends. And as our want, and the Sierras here is full of old mining camps or what was a mining camp. And there's properties that contain various remnants of mines and other things. And so we would just travel down old dirt roads looking to see what was out there. Well, you know, why does this road go off into the forest for 10 or 20 miles, and where does it go? So one day in the fall of 1970, we were traveling on a dirt road. We were almost 12 miles into the forest in an area with no population. No one's living there any longer. It's effectively gone wild. But it was an old stagecoach road that was then subsequently upgraded to be a logging road. And we came out through this forest into an opening in the middle of the this opening area overlooking the north or the middle fork of the Yuba. And there was a falling down house, a barn, and an orchard. And we all went, wow, what's that? Let's go check it out. And so we did. And it turned out that it was a huge orchard, and it was a quite high elevation, about 4,500 foot, which is well above the average zone where people are growing fruit and nuts these days. And it contained over 100 and almost 130 different fruit and nut trees. And
they're still living?
Yeah, they're still alive. 1970, and I, at that point, had no idea how old they were, except that they had lots of fruit on them. And other than the bears who were harvesting them at will, we were the only other species that had paid any attention to them, apparently, for a long time. So we started picking that fruit, and some of it was fantastic. I mean, it was like, wow. I never tasted an apple that tasted like this, or a pear, or a cherry, and the different things we picked on these properties and the property. And over time, we just kept going back up there, and eventually found out that this property was part right next to what was once a mining town, and that had been planted by four bachelor brothers, the Buck brothers, and they had put this orchard and a farm in to supply food for the miners. Well, you know, back in the day, food was not easy to get. is long ways to travel for it, and miners were making money and needing to eat. And so others found out, figured out that they could make a living by providing food for them. So these gentlemen planted an orchard, as well as grew grain and had a dairy and had an entire thing that they were supplying their neighboring mine. And then eventually that mine petered out. People moved away. The Buck brothers stayed there on their own, and they apparently brought their fruit to town, which was a 40-mile horseback or wagon ride. Anyway, at that point, that's pretty much all I knew. In 1970, in 1976, I started a farming supply business.
Peaceful Valley Farm Supply.
Peaceful Valley, correct. And when I was running that business in the early 80s, someone came in the store one day and said, oh, and by that time, I'd already started to find other old trees in other places, but just sort of sporadically, I'd see one here or there. And then somebody came in the store one day and said, did you know there used to be a nursery in Nevada City in the 1800s? And I said, no. And I was actually propagating and growing a bunch of these, what turned out to be heirloom plants for our customers, fruits and nuts and grapes and berries and such. And this gentleman directed me to go find where this location was. I ended up over at that spot. It turned out that the original house was still existing. And there was a plaque out on front of a driveway that described a little bit of this gentleman.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break, amigo, but when we come back, we get to meet Felix Gillette. Oh my goodness, what a treat, because this man had a lot to do with what you and I eat here in California, throughout the West Coast, and throughout America. Today, this is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson with amigo Bob Cantisano and you. Question of the day, why invest in saving seeds from the past when genetic engineering promises so much hope for the future? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080, right back. Do stay tuned to the Food Chain. Okay, folks, we're headed up to the Sierras, California's gold country, but we're discovering a different kind of gold. We're discovering a gold of some very interesting heritage plant genetics brought into the world of California by a horticulturalist by the name of Felix Gillette. And, gosh, I've never heard of Felix Gillette. And I guess he was well hidden up there in the Sierras until discovered by amigo Bob Cantisano, and that's who we're talking with today. So, amigo Bob, you discovered that he actually had a nursery going there in Nevada City, supplying plants not only for people around the Sierra foothills there, but all over the world.
Yes, he did. Actually, Felix operated his nursery, opened in 1871. He had 16 acres of nursery production, which back in the day, and even today, that's a lot of ground.
A lot of ground.
And he sold plants till he passed in 1908, fell out of a tree pruning and died of an infection in his shoulder wound. And then a gentleman took it over and ran it until the 1960s, which at that point in time, it was the oldest operating nursery in California. And Joy actually had the second real nursery in California. There was a gentleman in the Bay Area near Fremont who started one. But the difference between these two people was that Felix was French, and he had the French connection. He had family and contacts in France. And France at the time, and still by many people's reckoning, is the culinary capital of Europe. And he started bringing plants over initially from France, eventually from about 35 countries around the world. And sold plants to people everywhere. We have records of him selling things to people in Russia and Michigan and the Northwest, as well as around here. Because back in the day, plants were traded and shipped. Amazingly, it took a long time on wagons and ships and such, but people could ship things around the world, and people were into trying out new things. And so European varieties were new in the United States, with a few exceptions. There were things that had been brought earlier, but Felix was the first one to really get into bringing in the best and doing his own breeding. And as it turned out, brought in most of the commonly grown fruits, nuts, grapes that are still being grown and made California and the Pacific Northwest famous in agriculture.
Well, he being French, his name probably wasn't pronounced Gillette, was it?
No, actually, it's Gillet. Gillet. Uh-huh. And Fili is actually, if you're really French, you say Fili Gillet. So we kind of hybridized pollen field.
Well, I'll tell you what, if it's gilet instead of Gillette, his plants are probably worth much more just on that basis alone. So, almonds, cherries, table wine and raisin grapes, peaches, plums, strawberries, and roses. My goodness, just about everything he is bringing into the country. Now, how did that compare with, like, Luther Burbank, the other great plant introduction guy?
Yeah, well, Felix started about almost 25 years before Luther got started. They both had remarkable success. I can say that a lot of plant material, I've made presentations on Felix to the Luther Burbank Society, and a fair amount of plant material that Luther started with came from Felix, and Luther used it as some of his breeding stock, as well as they had similar varieties. And there are definitely indications that things that Gillet grew, Mr. Burbank appropriated, and is a common phenomenon back in the day.
It probably still is, isn't it?
Yeah. But here's what I can say for a fact. There are only really two plants of Burbank's introductions that are still commonly grown in agriculture. That's the russet Burbank, or the most common russet potato, and the Santa Rosa plum.
Yep.
Those are pretty much what's left. Gillet has dozens and dozens and dozens of varieties that he introduced that are still the mainstays of commercial agriculture. And for example, all the walnuts grown in California, which is the biggest producer in the world, are traced back to Nevada City at Felix Gillet, all of them. All the filberts or hazelnuts grown in Oregon, all of them, came from Gillet. All the almonds, all of them originally came from Gillet. Now, people have improved on these varieties, but the parents of these plants are Gillet's introduction. Every French varietal wine grape, you name it, Cabernet Sauvignon or Merlot or Petit Syrah or Charbonneau or Chardonnay or long list, guys, almost 50 of them, all those are Gillet introductions. The guy who brought these things here. And so these things became commercialized, and then it could go on. I mean, the Bartlett pear was actually known as the Bon Chrétien. It came from France, and it got renamed the Bartlett, you know, in the United States. The Bing cherry. The Bing cherry is a French variety, the Guignet Marbré de Languedoc, and it was renamed by Mr. Bing. The French prune, well, that one's the Catherine de Hen-Mammouth. Well, what do you want to call it? That's a mouthful. So they it's a French prune, and that's every prune pretty much people eat are French prunes. That's what they call it. Farmers call them that. So this gentleman was wise enough to see what was viable and successful in his home country as well as other places. The Thompson seedless grapes, another example. That's a kishmish. It came from Afghanistan, and Felix brought it here. The kishmish, he sold that to Mr. Thompson over at the Sutter Buttes by Yuba City, and Mr. Thompson made it famous because it was a great grape. Now, this kind of goes on through all these different pieces, and he was early enough and in an obscure enough spot that the level of fame that Mr. Burbank got didn't get attached.
Yeah, he's up there in the woods, and nobody's paying. But I just was, as you were describing all of those incredible introductions, I was thinking of Felix Gillet and the time in which he was establishing himself in California. And, you know, you've got all of these miners and all of these traders and all of these pioneers pouring into California. And nobody really knows what the hell's going on, right? Except Felix Gillet knows that here is a Garden of Eden without any plants in it.
Yes.
And my goodness.
It was wise enough to trial things before he sold them. In fact, he planted out a whole bunch of hazelnut varieties here in our area and found out that this was too hot of a climate for them, and then realized, and we don't know exactly how, but he realized that the climate of the Willamette Valley of Oregon was more suitable, similar to where they'd grown in Europe, and got people to plant them there. He's a pretty wise guy. He wrote a lot of articles. Back in the day, there was an ag mag called the Pacific Rural Press. By the way, anybody wants to read one of the history of agriculture in California, all that's digitized now, and it's a phenomenal weekly that was literally written by the practitioners. And you can go online, Pacific Rural Press, and see a tremendous amount of information. Well, anyway, Felix would write in there regularly, teaching people about how to grow a walnut or best way to grow a prune or however it might be. And then people got interested in what he had, and then eventually, and he had catalogs. That's how we've discovered all this. Yeah. Found a bunch of his catalogs, and that's how he got his name out there. And then these plants took. People found that they were successful, and California became the Garden of Eden for growing things.
And there we are today. Folks, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to ask Amigo Bob a couple philosophical questions, one of which is, why do these plants survive so long that Felix Gillet introduced? I mean, what is it about them that allows them to survive in a very competitive world? And the other question is, why on earth should we bother saving seeds from our past when genetic engineering promises so much hope for the future in the things it can do with whatever it wants to do it with? Do stay tuned. Right back. So, who populated America's West Coast with so many incredible perennial crops? Well, Felix Gillet did, of course. And a whole bunch of things. Almonds, cherries, table and wine and raisin grapes, peaches, plums, strawberries, roses. Oh, my goodness. What a wonderful world we live in because of people like Felix Gillet. The question on the table is, how did those crops that were introduced so long ago managed to survive until today? What is it about them that gave them that survivability? And also, why do we consider investing time and money in preserving the heritage of those crops, the seeds, the genetics, when science promises so much hope in its ability to re-engineer whatever we have? Those are the questions on the table today. We're going to go quickly to the phones, so, because Michael has a question for Amigo Bob about another organic pioneer. Michael, welcome to the food chain.
Yes, good morning. So I was wondering if the guest has heard of Barney Brickmont. He had a lot to do with establishing organic farming as an acceptable protocol in California. Barney Brickmont.
Thank you, Mike.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I knew Barney very well. In fact, he was part of the group that helped us form California Certified Organic Farmers, and he was one of the pioneering organic growers in the Santa Cruz area, and for a long time was the director of CCOF. Yep.
And I think
a couple of years ago, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think we had him on the food chain just shortly before he passed, and what an amazing man he was. And
yes, he was.
A lot of contribution there. Going back to my question, you know, what is it about these things that Felix Gillet introduced, these plants, that allowed them to survive for so long?
You know, that's a really good question, but we're going to call it genetic hardiness, for lack of a better term. We've just worked in four counties around us in the Sierras. We've found about 3,000 plants, pretty close to it now, old trees and grapes and such, on about 700 locations. And I'm sure there were many, many others here earlier that have passed on, but these plants that are still around 130, 140 years later.
And these plants have not been tended, have they?
No, the vast majority of them were tended when they were young, and they've effectively gone feral. You know, people left those mines or those farms, and these plants continue to grow, which is amazing, because we have an extreme climate of cold, hot summers, drought. And, I mean, right now, in fact, it's real interesting, this is the very third year of a drought. I just picked about 175 pounds of cherries off of a tree the other day that's 136 years old, and it just threw out a fantastic crop of fantastic fruit. So what I mean by that is that plants that are still surviving have genetics within them that are tolerant of all the variables of nature. And that's something you don't get in either a modern hybrid or a modern GMO plant. There is no track record there. These plants are effectively brand new. We have no idea if they're going to last 10, 20, 50 years. That 130-year-old cherry tree is effectively about 6 or 7 times longer lived than is considered normal for cherries planted today. The average life of a cherry orchard is about 25 years. So why is that? Well, we've bred away some of this hardiness, this genetic resistance to disease and to drought and frost and cold and such. in search of the bigger, some bigger production or whatever the case might be. And you ask why we might want to protect these things. Well, for example, apples is a lot of varieties we find around here, some from Jolay and some from others. That we find ones that have don't get any damage from some major pest, collie moth, which is the worm in apples. People spend a huge amount of effort and pesticide to control collie moth, both organic and conventionally. We got apple varieties, never see it, never find it, not a bit. Or blight is a serious disease in pears and apples that requires tremendous amount of effort and spraying. If, we have varieties here that are 130 years old, and they never have blight on them. So these plants have natural resistance, and that's why we want to protect them. And the other thing which is really important about their heritage is some of them have the very best flavors. I just was eating some of these cherries that we dried this week. They're the best dried cherries I've ever eaten, hands down. We've taken stuff, these things, these different plants, to the Heirloom Expo.
You'll save me some.
Yeah, exactly. I will.
And you know what? The interesting thing that
we've left behind.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is they're not on the supermarket shelves because only those varieties that we have selected for other purposes are there now. And we've kind of lost that flavor. We've lost the nutrient content. My goodness, to get the same amount of iron that an apple had in 1950, we now have to eat 26 apples. It's just, it's a head scratcher. And yet here are the genetics that you're finding running amok on their own. They're on their own. They're taking care of themselves.
Exactly. And that's one of the things we think is really important is that people could plant these things and get them established. You still certainly have to take care of them when they're young. But potentially then you can let them go and be on their own again and give your family and your grandkids a source of fruit and nuts without necessarily having to spend a whole lot of effort growing them.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, our last break. But when we come back, I have a sneaking suspicion Amigo Bob Cantisano is going to tell us what we can do to help preserve those genetics from the past. I mean, these plants are running amok up there in the Sierras, surviving on their own. And what we're talking about is grabbing those genetics and planting them in a garden, a mother garden, so that those will be able to hold on to those genetics for the future in case something happens with those genetically engineered varieties that we're cooking up in the scientific studios. Who knows where they're going to take us, but we know where these take us. So do stay tuned for a solution to a very interesting dilemma. Given our recently won ability to re-engineer life, they say our future now looks like an apple that will not spoil. Some, however, see hope in the past, and so are planting a mother orchard of heritage trees up in California's gold country. And that would be the members of the Felix Gillet organization. What is it called, Amigo Bob?
Felix Gillet Institute.
Institute.
Yeah, we're a nonprofit.
And you're a nonprofit, so you're not getting... who funds you? Always like to ask who funds people.
We have been funded exclusively by supporters of our project as well as from the nursery sales from the baby trees that we grow off these grandmother trees.
Good. So you're actually growing these trees out, and people can pick them up, and wow, that's pretty cool. So Felix Gillet Institute, and what is the web address?
It's felixgillet.org, and Felix is F-E-L-I-X, and the last name is Gillet, G-I-L-L-E-T.
Mm-hmm. Or Gillette as in English. Yeah. Now, the plan is to collect these genetics and plant them in a mother orchard. Now, what's a mother orchard?
Well, what's going on now is these trees are 120, 130, 40 years old, and some of them are starting to come to the end of their lives. We had a couple of them die on us this winter. So we're concerned that we're going to lose those genetics, even though they've been pretty hardy for a long time. So what we want to do is bring the best of these 3,000 trees. Different. They're all the same. They're all different. But the best varieties that we've found, we want to bring them into domestication. We want to bring at least one of each of these and grow them under our own care in our own farm where we can protect them and keep them both So in case the mother dies out in the woods or the grandmother, we've still got the genetics. And then also we can use the plant material from these in our orchard to use for propagating to provide for our nursery stock. So we're effectively trying to have a gene bank, mm-hmm. a living gene bank.
Now, that would be a very valuable gene bank, it would seem to me, when you have, you know, apples that codling moth don't bother. I mean, it would seem like there would be some genes in there that would be of great interest to industry, to the apple industry. Likewise, the pear blight and so on and so on and so on. So it would seem like that would be, those genes would be awfully valuable. Who, is there any way for the Felix Gillet Institute to patent them or own them?
Actually, we're not interested in doing that. We want to have this be open source. What we really want to do is get the breeders, and now we actually have the USDA interested in this and some University of California people, those breeders to take these genetics and breed them into modern varieties so we can create natural resistance to these kinds of problems. But we're not trying to profit from that. We think that's our gift to this process. But we also want to keep these plants alive so those genes are available for people to breed from.
And listeners out there can also take part in this too, can't they?
Yes, they can. It's quite expensive to develop an orchard. So we are doing crowdfunding, and many people are familiar with the concept of crowdfunding through Kickstarter. A friend of ours started a new website focused on supporting sustainable agriculture projects specifically. And it's called BarnRaiser.
BarnRaiser.com.
Yeah, no, it's actually .us. BarnRaiser.us, and we are up there. Our project's called Eureka, saving the last of the Gold Rush era perennial apples and orchards.
There you go, folks. So we're out of time, amigo Bob, but I just want to say go to BarnRaiser.us and go to Eureka and click on, and if you want, save the heritage in the seeds of our past. Thank you, amigo Bob, for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember, the second law of the food chain, the farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in that food.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.